Stupid, eh? Are you a stupid fool? Well, why can't you drive then? You can't even drive! Been great today, isn't it?
Well, hello everyone. I hope you're sitting comfortably and have got a cup of Nescafe Gold. Or you may have some tea, maybe. Weak lemon drink, perhaps. I hope you're sitting comfortably, because it's time for the Deepest Lore. On this stream, I'm going to be providing in-depth analysis of two of my favourite childhood films, both of which I watched dozens of times, if not hundreds, when I was a kid. These films are Mary Poppins and Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. However, I'm not going to be analysing them as films as such, but rather for their philosophical and political content. These will be reviews of the films, the likes of which you have not seen before. However, I will not be showing clips and stills from the films, just their front covers. Treat this more like an audio review, if you like. Alright, so let us begin. Mary Poppins, released in 1964, is one of Walt Disney's bona fide masterpieces. The main character of the film, its protagonist, is not Mary Poppins, but George Banks, the father of Michael and Jane, husband to Winifred and a junior partner at the Bank of England. The film is set in 1910, before World War I, when Britain was the chief superpower in the world and the empire still in full pomp and circumstance. There is a supreme confidence to the London of the film, which looks bright and gorgeous. It's a vision of England that, even in 1964, no one living will ever know again. However, the film does not have an entirely uncritical view of the Britain of 1910. While it seems an incredibly pleasant place, there are some problems inherent in the worldview of Mr. Banks himself. George Banks is the living embodiment of British utilitarian positivism. There is a refrain throughout the movie that he can't see past the end of his own nose. But that is because he is, as Thomas Carlyle might put it, a bean counter, enthralled to the dismal science. He knows the price of everything, but the value of nothing, as the cliché goes. There are still, however, many things to admire about George Banks as he strides about his house. First is his natural imperiousness. Near the start of the film, the children, Jane and Michael, have gone missing. It takes almost 4 minutes of screen time and 15 minutes within the world of the film for him to realise this, because first he must finish his song. His wife continually tries to tell him that they're gone, but he pays her no mind whatsoever. And then, by the time he finishes, then goes, "Winifred, where are the children?" This is not just a good punchline to a gag, but also reveals a degree of masculine self-absorption and self-importance that we must ultimately commend. Let us analyse the lyrics to the song he sings. "I feel a surge of deep satisfaction, much as a king astride his noble steed. When I return from daily strife to hearth and wife, how pleasant is the life I lead." Then Mrs. Banks interjects, "Dear, it's about the children." "Yes, yes, yes." So immediately we see Banks as a proud imperial patriarch who is the lord of his own manor, embodying the sense of supreme self-confidence that was in the air of the Britain of this moment. And the film does not condemn this. As we shall see later, it actually confirms and underlines Banks's central values, only with a few adjustments. Let us continue. I ran my home precisely on schedule. At 6:01, I march through my door. My slippers, pipe and sherry are due. At 6:02, consistent is the life I lead. It's grand to be an Englishman in 1910. King Edward's on the throne. It's the age of men. I'm the lord of my castle, the sovereign, the liege. I treat my subjects, servants, children, wife, with a firm but gentle hand, noblesse oblige. What's interesting about this song is that it was written by the Sherman brothers at a time when the USA was taking over from Britain as the great power in the world, and at a time when people like the Shermans were consolidating their own power as a kind of unofficial ruling class within America. They were not looking to the old British Empire to condemn it or make fun of it, but rather for inspiration. And it is interesting to see them evoke the notion of noblesse oblige, which would have been quite alien to those clever and classless and free Americans in 1964. Banks continues. It's 6:03 and the heirs to my dominion are scrubbed and tubbed and adequately fed. So I'll pat them on the head, send them off to bed. Ah, lordly is the life I lead. Notice how Banks's language subtly shifts to being positively aristocratic by the end. He may have some problems with his epistemological outlook on the world, but he is still fundamentally together. And what's interesting is that when Mrs. Banks finally tells him that the children are missing, he reacts in a masculine and decisive way. Mrs. Banks says, "They're not here, dear." Mr. Banks, "What? Of course they're here. Where else would they be? Why should they? They should have been bathed and in bed by now. It's already 6:15. And then at the back of the room, this is the stage directions, the constable begins to lead Jane and Michael up to the stage through the centre aisle. Mrs. Banks, "But George, they ran away from Katie Nana. They're missing again." Mr. Banks, "Missing? I'll deal with this." Using the phone, upstage left. "George Banks here, 17 Cherry Tree Lane. It's a matter of urgency. I should like you to send a policeman around immediately." And then the constable, having reached the top of the stairs, rings the door. Mrs. Banks open. She says, "The policeman's here." And he says, "What? Well, I never. What a wonderful service." Now, of course, the joke is that the policeman has already brought the children back. But the film shows the British state as being efficient and functional and incredibly safe. The model patriarchal society. When Mrs. Banks hugs the children, Mr. Banks retorts, "Don't be so emotional, dear." It transpires that the children have lost their nanny, which is the sixth in 4 months. Mr. Banks decides to take control again and says, "We need one who will be firm, respectable, and take no nonsense. She must act like a general who gives commands, lays down rules, and ensures discipline at all times." But then the children write their own letter for their perfect nanny. They want a nanny, in contrast to the one that Banks asked for, who has a cheery disposition, who plays games of all sorts, who will take them on outings, who won't scold and dominate them. Mr. Banks promptly throws the letter into the fire, and of course the pieces of that letter float up, and it's this letter that ultimately draws Poppins into their lives. And when she's hired, it quickly becomes obvious to the children and to the audience that Mary Poppins is everything they've ever wanted, practically perfect in every way. But what the audience might miss, even from her very first scene, is that she mentions that she is also quite firm. And the kicker, to the whole film, perhaps less obviously, is that Mary Poppins is the nanny who can give commands, who is firm, who ensures discipline at all times. That is, she is the nanny that Mr. Banks wants too. She is, in fact, the perfect Edwardian nanny. And while it is easy to spot the Poppins that the children want, you know, in the famous scenes where they're magically tidying up their room, jumping into chalk pictures, having the tea party on the ceiling, the Banks version of Poppins might need a little bit of teasing out. She always sticks to the rules. She always picks up on any misdemeanors from Jane or Michael. For example, at one point, Michael is lolloping with one foot on the pavement and one on the road, and she very quickly upbraids him. When they had the horse race in the chalk picture, Poppins insists on leaving to keep the schedule. She takes every Thursday off, and we see her stick to this religiously. When they have the tea party on the ceiling, she insists on cutting it short to stick to the schedule, even though it makes everyone sad and makes Uncle Albert cry. In fact, Poppins, in many ways, is just as imperious as Mr. Banks. She practically always gets her own way. She takes no nonsense from anyone at all. She owns everybody that she comes across, including Mr. Banks. In one scene, Mr. Banks is in a particularly bad mood, and he's gearing up to fire Mary Poppins, and he launches back into his earlier song with some more verses. He says, "A British nanny must be a general. The future empire lies within her hands. And so the person that we need to mould a breed is a nanny who can give commands. A British bank is run with precision. A British home requires nothing less. Tradition, discipline, and rules must be the tools. Without them, disorder, catastrophe, anarchy. In short, we have a ghastly mess. A British bank is run with precision. A British home requires nothing less. Tradition, discipline, and rules must be the tools. Without them, disorder, chaos, moral disintegration. In short, you have a ghastly mess." But then Mary Poppins disarms him by chirping in herself. She says, "I quite agree." Now, some of the audience may be thinking, well, does she really agree with her? It's quite a, you know, it's quite an old school set of values that Banks outlines there. Does Poppins really agree, or is it just some stratagem from her? But I actually think she does agree. But anyway, Banks continues. He says, "The children must be moulded, shaped and taught, that life's a looming battle to be faced and fought. In short, I'm disturbed to hear my children talking about popping in and out of chalk pavement pictures, consorting with racehorse persons, fox hunting. Yes, well, I don't mind that so much. At any rate, it's tradition. But tea parties on the ceiling? I ask you, having tea parties on the ceiling and highly questionable outings, maybe they're the other kind. If they must go on outings, these outings ought to be fraught with purpose, yes, and practicality. These silly words like..." And then Poppins butts in, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. And popping through pictures, "have little use, fulfill no basic need." Note Banks's utilitarianism coming in again. He can't actually see the function of those outings, which do actually have a use. He just can't see the use of the outings that Poppins has taken them on. Obviously, we have seen them, but he thinks they're a waste of time, and obviously they're not a waste of time. Anyway, he says they've got to learn the honest truth. Despite their youth, they must... And then Poppins cuts in herself about the life you lead. And Banks now, he's on side with Poppins. Exactly. And this is Poppins now inserting her own verses. She says, "They must feel the thrill of totting up a balanced book, 1,000 ciphers neatly in a row, when gazing at a graph that show the profits up. A little cup of joy should overflow. Precisely, it's time they learnt to walk in their footsteps, to tread your straight and narrow path with pride. Tomorrow, just as you suggest, pressed and dressed, Jane and Michael will be at your side." And now Poppins persuades Mr. Banks to take the children to the Bank of England, where he works. Now, there is actually nothing in Mr. Banks's basic view of the world with which Poppins disagrees. She would prefer that he was less utilitarian and more in touch with his human side, let's just say. But in terms of his values, his traditional values, she doesn't actually disagree with him at all. It's just a case of his epistemology, I guess. Poppins' view of Banks is a little like the German idealist critique of Anglo-utilitarianism. He is missing crucial aspects of life by viewing it through a purely materialist lens. Anyway, while we are At the bank, we are treated to perhaps the most imperialistic song in the whole film, Fidelity Fiduciary, perhaps one of the most intelligent songs ever penned for a kid's movie. And this is Banks and his colleagues, his senior colleagues at the Bank of England. They say, if you invest your tuppence wisely in the bank, safe and sound, soon that tuppence safely invested in the bank will compound. And you'll achieve that sense of conquest as your affluence expands in the hands of the directors who invest as proprietary demands. You see, Michael, you'll be part of railways through Africa. Exactly. Dams across the Nile. The ships, tell them about the ships. Fleets of ocean greyhounds. Majestic, self-amortizing canals. It fires the imagination. Plantations of ripening sea, all from tuppence, prudently, fruitfully, frugally invested in the, to be specific, in the Dawes, Tomes, Mousley, Grubbs, Fidelity, Fiduciary Bank. Now, this is a genuinely exciting, vital vision of empire based on sound Victorian economic principles, saving as the basis for genuine capital investment. And they continue. Now, Michael, when you deposit your tuppence in the bank account, soon you'll see that it blossoms into credit of a generous amount semi-annually. And you'll achieve that sense of stature as your influence expands to the high financial strata that established credit now commands. You can purchase first and second trust deeds. Think of the foreclosures, bonds, chattels, dividends, shares, bankruptcies, debtor sales, opportunities, all manner of private enterprise, shipyards, the mercantile, collieries, tanneries, incorporations, amalgamations, banks. You see, Michael, tuppence, patiently, cautiously, invested in the, to be specific, in the Dawes, Tomes, Mousley, Grubbs, Fidelity Fiduciary Bank. I mean, it's a remarkable song, and yet, sadly, Michael does not want to deposit the tuppence in the bank, and he causes a run on the bank, which ends up getting his father fired. But Michael, as a high time preference child, would rather give the tuppence to the bird lady outside to feed the birds. Now, we can debate on whether or not his decision was sensible, but it serves to set up the basic lesson of the film, the one that Poppins ultimately teaches Banks, which is that a purely material view of the world can cut you off from your loved ones and stop you seeing what is truly important. She is not saying that investment or finance cannot be part of this picture. Indeed, Banks is given his job back and made a senior partner by the end of the film, but rather that men need to be in touch with their moral intuitions as well as their intellects, and it's okay to have a laugh, a spoonful of sugar. There is, however, and sadly, one jarring note of total subversion in the film, and that is the presence of Mrs. Banks, who is a suffragette, which is to say, a feminist campaigning for votes for women. However, I am not sure that the film straightforwardly champions this. Mrs. Banks is shown continually to be quite a feckless character, undermined by the eye-rolling and head-shaking of her servants. The devastating consequences of her subversive actions to future generations are ominously foreshadowed by the lyrics of his song, Sister Suffragette. She says, "Our daughters' daughters will adore us, and they'll sing in grateful chorus." Now, by 1964, this was obviously an absurd claim, and I can only imagine that the Sherman brothers knowingly inserted this line as a nod to the tragic consequences of universal suffrage. But in the overall scheme of the film, Mrs. Banks is quite silly and a rather harmless distraction to proceedings. The soul of the film is conservative, it's traditional. It ends with Mr. Banks reasserting his role as a patriarch, but now with a deeper bond with his wife and with his children. London is safe and happy, and the sun is not setting on the British Empire, at least not yet. I suppose the dark cloud of Mrs. Banks's idiotic actions hang over the end of the film, but it doesn't linger on that note. Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was released in 1971 on a modest budget and made a modest return. Roald Dahl didn't like it, despite being credited with writing the screenplay, because of changes made to the plot without his consent. But following repeats on television, by the time the VHS market come around in the 1980s, it had already become a cult classic. Now, although I'm not discussing the films as films as such here, I will point out that much of its effectiveness lies in the superb performance of Gene Wilder as Wonka, especially for his detachment, which at times borders on callousness. It's a mesmerizing performance which adds its own layers of meaning to the film beyond the script. At its heart, this is a medieval morality tale, but before I get to that, we have to mention the problem of Grandpa Joe. In the movie, unlike in the book, Charlie does not have a father. This means that Charlie's mother has to raise him alone and look after four old people who are bedridden. All she has is a job at the laundry. They are not just poor in this film, they are destitute, below the breadline, living on cabbage soup. And they are so poor that they have to save up to get Charlie a single chocolate bar. I think they live in a two-bedroom shack with an ancient television set. It's filthy. The walls are yellowing and damp. I mean, it's extreme poverty. But we learn that Grandpa Joe still somehow finds the budget to smoke. I am far from the first person to point this out. He has in fact been described as the internet's most hated man, and there's even a Reddit group called Grandpa Joe Hate dedicated to, you know, hating Grandpa Joe. But when Charlie gets his golden ticket, the fact that Grandpa Joe suddenly springs out of bed and is somehow well enough to go with him after years of simply being a burden to his mother is, well, from any perspective, it's frankly shocking. If anyone deserves to go to the chocolate factory with Charlie, it's his mother. From within the lore of the film, the fact it has to be Grandpa Joe is justified by the idea that he has an almost childlike enthusiasm for Wonka and the lore around Wonka and for chocolate, and that this is the tiny ray of light in Charlie's otherwise quite miserable life. And so, while Grandpa Joe is not bringing in any money, he is at least performing the vital task of keeping Charlie's spirits relatively high despite desperately tough times. But is this enough? I have found a blog post online written in 2014 by someone called Famous Shia. It's called Five Reasons Grandpa Joe is an Absolute Jerk in Willy Wonka. Let's study the evidence that Shia has collected here. Well, number one is he doesn't give a damn about his family except for chocolate. I've already covered this, and this, I think, is the main charge against Grandpa Joe. But this blog post picks up on at least four other charges against him. Number two, he almost gets his grandson and himself killed and has no regrets. And this is Shia, this is from the blog. One reoccurring theme throughout Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory is that the kids would get themselves in trouble and face dire consequences for their actions. But if you watch the movie, Charlie never really falls into temptation except for swiping some everlasting gobstoppers from Slugworth. In the bubble room scene, it wasn't Charlie who was tempted to drink the fizzy lifting drink, but that old codger Grandpa Joe, who eggs him on to take a swig with him. Gee, Gramps, don't you know they teach Charlie and the kids in school not to succumb to peer pressure? So anyway, up and away they go like Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and float away with bubbles like fairies. It wouldn't take long for them to figure out they done goof as a giant rotating steel fan is at the top of the chamber they're floating up in, and they seem like there's no way out of this predicament. Then, with pure dumb luck, Grandpa Joe lets out a belch, doesn't even excuse himself, that jerk, and the floating effect reverses. The two then burp all the way down in a display of bad manners and finally make it back to the ground. So what does Grandpa Joe say after getting the two of them cut up into little pieces? Come on, Charlie, let's catch up with the others. No apologies, no regrets, no nothing. This old bastard is determined to get a lifetime supply of chocolates, even if it means life or death. So, yeah, I mean, this is a fair point. It's actually implied in the film. just through the way he behaves and is dressed. I mean, he's kind of got this almost like 1930s hobo vibe about him, that Grandpa Joe is a bit of a chancer. And he's a dodgy character. Certainly, he shows himself to be a man of low moral fibre in this scene, as described by the blogger here. And this retroactively makes the fact that he's been poncing off Charlie's mother even worse. And this is the third point from the blogger. He shows no concern over the welfare of others, especially children. This is Shia. He says, he doesn't give a damn about his family. Think we should have care and compassion for others? Of course not. At the beginning of the Chocolate Factory tour, it is known that Grandpa Joe hates kids. Granted that all of them were brats. Notice how none of the other parents brutally berates them. Props to say no to Grandpa Joe for properly pointing out moments in the film where Joe shows his bitter side during the tour. So there's this group called Say No to Grandpa Joe that keeps pointing out the bitter moments from Grandpa Joe. This old bugger is quite unfazed seeing kids in situations where they'll likely meet their ultimate demise. For example, when Violet is up to the point where she's going to explode her guts all over the place as a bursting blueberry, Grandpa Joe just stands there and mutters to himself that she got what she deserved. He's particularly nasty with Rook Assault. Again, while she herself is a no-good, rotten brat, Grandpa Joe is the only one who shreds her to pieces by putting the verbal smackdown on her. And when she and her dad fell down the chute into the incinerator, he was gleeful those two were out of the question. While you can argue that Willy Wonka himself didn't show any sign of concern for the misbehaved kids, at least he knew for the fact that they'll be completely restored to their normal, terrible old selves. But not old Joe boy. He's just glad every other kid on the tour is presumably dead, so he and Charlie can get all the chocolate. Now, this analysis from the blogger is 100% true. Although most of Grandpa Joe's negative opinions of the children is justified in the course of the film, he does seem especially nasty in these moments, and there's a hint of some seething underlying bitterness and resentment to him. We do not know anything about Grandpa Joe's history or background other than the fact that he's been leeching from his daughter for years. So maybe he does have a lot of pent-up resentment against other people for some reason. So the fourth point from the blogger, he's somewhat of a sexual deviant. While it may not be so apparent as the others, there's some subliminal moments in the movie showing Grandpa Joe to be a pervert. In the scene where they get stuck in the shrinking room at the beginning of the tour, Mrs. TV screams, "Somebody is touching me," implying somebody squeezed her ass or something. As you can see in the image, and obviously I can't show that here, she gives Gramps a dirty look as he knows the jig is up. And thankfully, Grandpa Joe keeps his hands to himself for the rest of the tour. Now, this is a weaker point for sure, but it is suggested at least that Grandpa Joe is a bit handy, at least in that one scene. And let's not forget, he's a married man. You know, Grandpa Josephine is still at home. She didn't get to go to the chocolate factory. And now not only is he, you know, does he get to go to the factory, he's using it to feel up other women. What a scumbag. And then the fifth point made by this blogger says, he's a filthy, lying and hypocritical bastard to Willy Wonka. As much as the movie wanted you to think that Slugworth was the main villain in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the ending of the film shows that it was Grandpa Joe who's the real villain. As Grandpa and Charlie are the last survivors of the factory tour, Grandpa Joe inquires about the lifetime supply of free chocolate, but Wonka gives him the cold shoulder and shows them the exit. Infuriated, Gramps storms into Wonka's office to see what the hell is going on. Of course, Mr. Wonka ain't no fool, as he tears Grandpa Joe a new one in one of the most memorable lines in film history. He's talking about, of course, "You get nothing. Good day, sir." That's right, folks. Willy knew that those two were up to something earlier on, fooling around with a fizzy lifting drink, and I don't blame him for being pissed off with them. I would throw a hissy fit to learn that a dirty old man like Grandpa Joe was smearing his hands all over my property. Sorry, This blogger has a turn of phrase. It's probably some 12-year-old or something, but it's making me laugh. Meanwhile, Gramps plays dumb and demands that they get their fair share of chocolate. The ultimate kicker to all this comes when Charlie and Grandpa Joe are about to leave the office, and Grandpa says, "I'll get even with him if it's the last thing I do." And then he adds, "If Slugworth wants a gobstopper, he'll get one." Now let's flash back to the beginning, where Charlie asks Grandpa Joe about the whole deal with Willy Wonka's factory and Mr. Slugworth. Grandpa tells Charlie that Slugworth is a bad man who can't be trusted at all and wanted Wonka out of business. Now let's fast forward to the scene where the kids are about to get Wonka's secret candy, an everlasting gobstopper. Wonka goes on to tell them that they can only have one each and not to tell anyone else about sharing this secret to Slugworth, which would put Wonka out of business. As Wonka passes around the gobstoppers, Veruca Salt wasn't so subtle in trying to be sneaky, but Grandpa Joe, on the other hand, says, "What about Charlie? What about Charlie?" Somewhere along the lines in the confusion, Grandpa Joe picks up on what's going on and says Charlie never got a gobstopper. Now clearly Gramps was in on the whole scheme to steal the everlasting gobstopper and give it to Slugworth. Well, of course, Charlie too, but I got the feeling that Joe conned the poor kid into doing it, like he did with the fizzy lifting drink. Fortunately, Charlie has a thing called a conscience, which his grandfather doesn't have, and returns the stolen candy to Wonka. Wonka congratulates Charlie for being honest, says he won, reveals Slugworth was Wonka's assistant to test the kid's honesty, yada yada, and they all live happily ever after. And it is true that Grandpa Joe is motivated by what he feels is owed to him. He's constantly going on about the reward, you know. It's framed in the film as if, you know, he's thinking of Charlie's best interest, but I sometimes wonder about his real motivations there. While Charlie seems motivated by his moral instinct, which seems entirely lacking in Grandpa Joe. Now let's leave him for the side for the moment. Speaking of morality, let us get stuck into the matter, into the manner in which Wonka weeds out each of the children and upbraids them for their moral feelings. The addition of the Slugworth character, who's not present in the book, I mean, Slugworth is mentioned in the book, but he's not like an actual character like he is in this, makes this slightly more sinister, because Wonka gives them an additional loyalty test to see who would sell him out when push came to shove. And of course, all of them do, including Grandpa Joe, with the sole exception of Charlie. And this is enough to give him the chocolate factory in the end. But it's also an interesting indictment on the moral character of practically everyone else in the world of the film. In fact, the film shows an America riddled by materialism and greed, corruption, and the other four children are simply ghastly. The Oompa Loompas act as a kind of Greek chorus in the film, and their songs, as each of the kids see their demise, are used to carry some pretty didactic moral messages. Let us go through them one by one. So first, of course, is Augustus Gloop, who falls into Wonka's chocolate river, much to his chagrin. It's notable that Wonka is entirely unconcerned for the well-being of Gloop and is only concerned by the contamination of his chocolate. The Oompa Loompas sing, "Oompa Loompa, doobity-doo, I've got a perfect puzzle for you. Oompa Loompa, doobity-doo, if you are wise, you'll listen to me." Oompa Loompa, doodly-dee, if you are wise, you'll listen to me. What do you get when you guzzle down sweets, eating as much as an elephant eats? What are you getting? Terribly fat. What do you think will come of that? I don't like the look of it. If you are not greedy, you will go far. You will live in happiness too, like the Oompa Loompas do. So the Oompa Loompas think absolutely nothing of fat-shaming Augustus Gloop, and it is, of course, fully deserved. His mother in the film is also fat, of course, and it is strongly implied that she is the ultimate cause for his son's obesity. I do actually think, though, that of the four kind of nasty children, Augustus Gloop is probably like the least the least bad of them. I mean, yes, he's a big fat German pig, but you know, the Gloops seem, at least they seem all right. You know, they seem kind of, you know, beyond their gluttony. They seem like decent people otherwise. Anyway, next is Violet Beauregard, the girl who spends all day, every day, chewing gum. She is depicted in the film as a loathsome, loudmouth brat with a sleazy car salesman father. Again, it is strongly suggested that Violet's lack of general manners is the result of having no decent role models in her life. And then the Oompa Loompas kick in. Oompa Loompa doobity doo, I've got another puzzle for you. Oompa Loompa doobity dee, if you are wise, you'll listen to me. Chewing gum's fine when it's once in a while, when it stops you from smoking and brightens your smile. But it's repulsive, revolting and wrong, chewing and chewing all day long, the way that a cow does. Oompa Loompa doobity dee, da, given good manners, you will go far. You will live in happiness too, like the Oompa Loompas do. Now, to all this, Wonka's only reaction is to say, well, 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 two naughty, nasty little children gone, three good, sweet little children left. The next kid to go is perhaps the biggest brat of them all, Veruca Salt. I should mention here that the actress who plays her, Julie Dawn Cole, gives a superb performance, as does the amazing British comedy actor Roy Kinnear playing her father. Aside from Wilder, these are likely the best performances in the film. The characters are utterly realised, and Mr. Salt is the ultimate doting, elbowing parent. Veruca Salt is not just spoiled, she's almost sadistic. The point of her tantrums is not really because she wants anything at all, but rather to test whether her father can actually achieve the demand. It's really quite dark. And here's what the Oompa Loompas have to say about it. Oompa Loompa doobity doo, I've got another puzzle for you. Oompa Loompa doobity dee, if you are wise, you'll listen to me. Who do you blame when your kid is a brat, pampered and spoiled like a Siamese cat? Blaming the kids is a lie and a shame. You know exactly who's to blame. The mother and the father. Oompa Loompa doobity da. If you are not spoiled, then you will go far. You will live in happiness too, like the Oompa Loompas do. Now, what's kind of interesting here is that the morality of the film, as well as that of Wonka himself, has no trouble punishing the child, even as it recognises that the ultimate blame lies with the parents. And I like that. It's almost unfair. But it's also a moral absolutism that is quite rare in movies made since about 1965. And finally, there's Mike TV, who is, like the other American kid in the film, totally loud and obnoxious and lacking in even basic manners. He is the flip side of Violet Beauregard. If she represents the vapid and hollow world of bubblegum, perhaps bubblegum pop, certainly of, you know, addictive substances, he represents the gaudy world that comes through the television set. Between them, they are a near total condemnation of American culture, which I can only assume is rooted in Roald Dahl sensibilities rather than those of the Americans who actually made this film. Mrs. TV is seen throughout the film as a bit of a know-it-all and is also, like almost everyone else in the world of the film, detestable in her own way. There's something almost puritanical about this world. We can see the absolute depravity of mankind in every individual. People are not just sinners, they are grotesque, self-seeking, profane. They have unlimited appetites, as Machiavelli would put it. Oompa Loompa doobity doo, I've got another puzzle for you. Oompa Loompa doobity dee, if you're wise, you'll listen to me. What do you get from a glut of TV, a pain in the neck and an IQ of 3? Why don't you simply try reading a book? Or could you just not bear to look? You'll get no commercials. Oompa Loompa doobity da, if you're not greedy, you will go far. You will live in happiness too, like the Oompa Loompas do. And like that, Mike TV is gone. What I really like about this film's moral vision, which is basically Wonka's vision, is that there's a deep misanthropy in it. It's so unforgiving. It's like an old school Carlylean, justice as revenge. Wonka has already shut out the rest of the modern world. He's revolting against the modern world, if you like. Wonka is a man among the ruins. He's been riding the tiger for many years. And then when he does invite the outside world in, it's only to metaphorically destroy it with his own moral absolutism. So for my money, Wonka should be considered a reactionary hero. All right, let's leave it there for today. If anybody sent any super chats or anything else in, I'll have to catch up with them at another time, because as you're watching this, I'll be out picking up the keys to AA Lodge, which I found out actually that I'm not going to be able to access until mid-November, which is slightly irritating, but there we are. Remember, course on in the courses at the academic agency, there's a sale, autumn 25. Cigar stream back tomorrow night. Be sure to check out the reading on Skeptical Waves. We're doing Jihad versus McWorld. And most importantly of all, boys and girls, and you, Billy at the back, and you, I can see you all in chat there. Most importantly of all, get out.